We're going to turn our attention back to Genesis chapter 11 today and roll back the verses to number 27 as we zero in on the story of Abram, or Abraham, as he will later be called. And we need to understand the bigger family picture to appreciate the fullness, the depth of this story of Abraham. So Genesis chapter 11, verse 27 says this: "Now these are the generations of Terah," or the beginnings of Terah. This is the story of the Terah family. Terah fathered Abram. He's mentioned first because he's the most important person that is a son of Terah. Nahor, who also plays very much in the story of Abram. And Haran. Now, Haran is the eldest son named here of Terah. And we know that he was actually born when Terah was 70 years of age. And it would appear that by this time in the history of mankind, the beginnings of a family were happening more in the second half, closer to the middle, of the first century of life. Previous to that, even after the flood, it seems that the first named son was almost always born in that first quarter of the second century, or somewhere around the first quarter of the second century of a person's life. But the age, the average lifespan, is deteriorating. It will eventually settle in at a maximum of around 120, and a more average around 70 or 80 or into the 90s. But this story of Abram takes place while this part of humanity is still very long-lived. So Terah has Haran when he's 70, and we will discover that he has Abram when he's 130, which means big brother Haran is already 60 whenever his little brother Abram is born. And then we'll hear about Sarai, or Sarai, who is born a few years after Abram, when Terah is 139 years of age. Back to the text. Haran, so the big brother, the eldest son named here of Terah, he died in the presence of his father Terah in the land of his kindred, in Ur of the Chaldeans. And I've already developed this understanding that the ancient people had, and I think it is the correct understanding, that Chaldea was located upriver from Babylon, and therefore cannot be the Ur that so many people try to focus on in the commentaries, which is downriver from Babylon, down near the mouth of the Tigris and Euphrates river system into the Persian Gulf. So Ur of the Chaldees seems better related to a place called today Urfa Sanli. And it is, interestingly enough, only about 25 miles north of another town that is very specifically mentioned here in the early story of Abram, Haran. And we know exactly where that town is. And so Ur of the Chaldeans seems to be just a little upstream, even from Haran. So after Haran dies, we are then told this, verse 29. Abram and Nahor took wives. So the two remaining named brothers get married. Now, did they get married before Big Brother Haran died? We don't know. Remember, he was about 60 when Abram was born. And Nahor seems to be younger than Abram. So if he lived into his 200s, that would be roughly the time where Abram is approaching his own 60s and 70s, which is actually where the story of Abram officially starts, when he's 75 years old and leaves for Canaan. So verse 29, Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai. Now let's talk about their names here. Abram's name means exalted father or my exalted father. And it's not a reference to him. It's actually probably a reference to his grandfather. When I've done my genealogical lists using the Septuagint, the Greek Septuagint, Alexandrian Septuagint, I discovered by those standards that Abram's grandfather died the year before he was born. So it would make very good sense for Terah to honor his own father by naming his son Abram in honor of my exalted father, my dearly departed exalted father. Now, Sarai, who is also a daughter of Terah, her name, which is actually Sarai, is the way we should pronounce it to get closer to the Hebrew. Her name means Lady Lord, if you will, or princess, or my princess. Sar in Hebrew is the idea of somebody in charge of something. And so we either say prince or lord. And so she is the feminine form of that, and perhaps even the diminutive form of that. And you can appreciate a dad who names his daughter my princess. Now, those two get married. They are half brothers and sisters, which is not a big deal, because this is back when the gene pool is still very deep and wide, and there's no danger of birth defects, no huge danger. It won't be until the time of Moses that God starts making rules about not getting married and having children with close relatives. And that's still hundreds of years in the future from this story. So we've got the first couple in this family, Abram and Sarai. The name of Nahor's wife was Milcah. Interestingly enough, Milcah's name means queen, or queenie, if you will. So he named Abram's little brother marries a woman named Queen or Queenie, and she was the daughter of their big brother, Haran. And he was also the father of a couple of other kids, Milcah and Iscah. So we've got two couples here who are the only remaining family members in Terah's household. His oldest son is dead and gone. He left behind some kids, which are either getting married or are under the care of their grandfather. One of them that we will find here very soon is Lot, the son of Haran, who becomes the ward, if you will, of his grandfather, Terah. Verse 30 reminds us of a very important part of the story. Now, Sarai was barren. She had no child. So even if they got married when Abram was in his early 70s, he's going to leave for the promised land when he's 75. So let's say just a few years before that, he gets married, and Sarai is in her early 60s, maybe late 50s. They start trying to have kids, and they can't. And it seems as if she is the one that's unable to have the children. Verse 31. Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife. And what we don't read here in the text is that also Nahor and his wife, Queenie, they come along as well. They are part of the larger household of Terah. And so they follow him. And what do? They went forth together from Ur of the Chaldeans to go into the land of Canaan. But when they came to Haran, which is different than the name of the man, the man's name has something to do with a mountain. This name has something to do with a crossroads, a caravan crossroad or stop. But they came as far as Haran, which is only about 25 miles south along the Belik River valley from Ur of the Chaldeans. It says they settled there. Now, this is where things get intriguing when you do the in-between line evidence. We know from the book of Acts, thanks to the prophet Stephen, that Abram was spoken to by God while he was still at Ur of the Chaldees. And that was a call for Abram to leave his family, to leave the place of his birth, and travel to Canaan, to a place that he would be shown later. So that's the beginning of the Abrahamic story. But here we have him leaving with his father for Canaan. So what's going on? How's this all happening? And I already mentioned this, and I'm going to go into a little bit better detail this time, is that we have the understanding from a story that comes later in the book of Genesis. This is in Genesis 31 at verse 53, that it was understood that the God who called Abram in Genesis chapter 12 was also the God of Nahor, his brother, who ends up settling at the city of Haran, and of their collective father, which would be Terah. That means that Terah must have embraced the true and living God while he was at Ur of the Chaldees, and somehow that is related to him wanting to go to Canaan. And so this is the best way to mesh all of that together. And it's helped out by a little tradition amongst the Jewish people that we know existed in the first century, because it's recorded in Josephus's Antiquities of the Jews, book number 1. In fact, let me read to you from Antiquities, book 1, chapter number 7. And the subsection is section 1 of chapter number 7. It says this about Abram. He was a person of great sagacity, meaning he was really wise, both for understanding all things and persuading his hearers, and not mistaken in his opinions, for which reason he began to have higher notions of virtue than others had. And he determined to renew and to change the opinion all men happened then to have concerning God. So at that time, the general population believed in multiple gods who controlled multiple areas and multiple situations. And Abram, according to Jewish tradition, began to reject that. It says, "For he was the first that ventured to publish this notion that there was but one God, the creator of the universe, and that as to other gods, if they contributed anything to the happiness of men, that each of them afforded it only according to his appointment and not by his own or their own power." This, his opinion, was derived from the irregular phenomena that was visible both at land and sea, as well as those that happened to the sun and the moon and all the heavenly bodies. Basically, it was understood at this time that nature was controlled by these variant gods and goddesses. And Abram at this time says, that doesn't make any sense, because those things seem to be controlled themselves by powers above and by patterns. Here's some more of the quote from Josephus. "If," said he, "these bodies had power of their own, they would certainly take care of their own regular motions. But since they do not preserve such regularity, they make it plain that in so far as they cooperate to our advantage, they do it not of their own abilities, but as they are subservient to him that commands them, to whom alone he ought justly to offer our honor and thanksgiving." So basically, he said, it looks to me like nature is controlled elsewhere, because it doesn't control itself. It seems to be out of whack from time to time. And so it makes more sense that there is someone else above that. Now, he's not just coming up with this on his own. We know that traditions have been handed down from the time of the flood, even a few generations back. Abram is 10th generation from the flood. That there was one God who created everything and then destroyed it in the flood and then restarted humanity and the world. And so Abram is saying that makes more sense, that there's only one God. And it would appear then that this caused trouble for him to be suggesting there's not multiple gods. Continuing with Josephus, "For which doctrines, when the Chaldeans and other people of Mesopotamia raised a tumult against him, he thought fit to leave that country." So according to Josephus, one of the things that prompted Abram to leave was the fact that his monotheistic approach offended the local polytheists. Now, we have good evidence of how polytheistic these folks were, because it just so happens that one of the most ancient idol collections is only about 8, maybe 9 miles northeast from Ur of the Chaldees, Urfa, if you will. It's a place called Göbekli Tepe. It's up on the mountain, about 8 or 9 miles northeast of Urfa. And so Abram is clearly rejecting polytheism, and that gets him in trouble. And I think it's at that point then that God speaks to him. Remember, in the book of Hebrews, we are told that if we seek God, he will respond. He's looking for people that are looking for him. And so in a moment, we'll be reading from chapter number 12 in Genesis about how God speaks to Abram as the one true God. Now, one last bit before we go there. It appears to me that when Abram announces to his family, that is to Terah, his dad, to Nahor, his brother, and all the other family members, including Lot, "I have been spoken to by the one true God. The Creator God has talked to me, and he has told me that I need to leave here," just at the foot of the mountain where that great polytheistic temple is, Göbekli Tepe, "and I need to go southward into Canaan." I think that when he announced that, Terah said, "I believe you too. I believe what you've just said. I believe that there is a one true God who has spoken to you and by that is speaking to us. Let's all go. And that is exactly what we see happening here in Genesis chapter 11. It is Terah that says, let's leave Ur and head south toward Canaan. Now, they only make it as far as Haran, which is, like I said, only about 25 miles down the valley. And something happens. Apparently, Terah takes ill. He becomes sick, or he is stopped by what will kill him. Verse 32 of Genesis 11 says, the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. And we know that Abram was 75 years old when his father died there at Haran. And so that would put us into 2101 BC, because we're pretty confident with the beginning of Abram's story chronologically. Chapter number 12. There's a little bit of flashback here, or perhaps this is repetition of what God had already said to Abram when he was at Ur before his dad said, let's all go. Chapter 12, verse 1. Now, he who is said to Abram, go from your country, from your kindred, and your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. So God has offered to this man in his 75th year the opportunity to be blessed by the Creator of the universe if he will just obey this command to head south and to keep going until God tells him to stop. And we know that Abram does. And in Hebrews chapter 11, this is highlighted as evidence of his faith. It's also mentioned in the book of James that this is evidence of his faith. He trusted God and obeyed and acted. So it takes action to put truth to your faith. But there's more to the story. Verse 3, I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you, I will curse. So God puts this Abrahamic blessing and curse on him at the very beginning of this story. Anybody that helps you out, I'll help them out. Anybody that causes trouble for you, I will cause trouble for them. And we will see that in action as this story progresses. And then one of the very important verbiages of the Abrahamic covenant, in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Later, this will be expressed with this wording, in your seed, Abraham, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. And when Paul makes commentary on that later passage in his Galatian letter, chapter number 3, he makes a big deal out of the fact that the seed word there is singular, and that that seed is specifically Jesus Christ. So, in effect, we are seeing here the messianic seed promise attach itself through divine choice to the line of Abraham. In you, Abraham, I am going to bless all the different ethnic groups on the planet. And the way that he's going to do that is by bringing Jesus through this Abrahamic line to become the Savior who lays down his life and resurrects bodily on the third day again as the atoning sacrifice for sin, as our Savior, and as our King of Kings and our Lord of Lords. So all of these things said to Abram at this time, first at Ur, now apparently at Haran, and he leaves and heads south. Now, he does not apparently take along his younger brother, Nahor. Nahor stays at Haran, and that is where we will find his family later in the story. But he does take someone else with him. Verse number 4, so Abram went as he who is had told him, and Lot went with him. Now, Abram is the eldest surviving son of Terah. That makes him the head of this family group, this patriarchal society. And so he is now the patron of Lot. Lot is his ward. And so Lot is going to travel with him, and Lot has to defer to him everywhere he goes. Nahor probably would have been in the same situation, but it appears as if Nahor's petition to remain where he's at is granted by Abram. Verse 4 finishes. Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. And Abram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people that they had acquired in Haran, and they set out to go to the land of Canaan. So it is a great big group of people that are traveling in this caravan heading south toward what will be the promised land.